Hi, my name is Sam Williams, and welcome to episode number 120 of my 60 Music Podcast, Millennial Throwback Machine. I'd like to welcome all you to episode number 120 of my 60 Music Podcast, the Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and for those of you who are just now discovering this podcast, either on the Apple Podcast app, or in Stitcher, or in iHeartRadio, on Google Play Music, or on Spotify, and you're wondering, so what the heck is this? I'm just going to give you a brief description of what the show's all about. Okay, so I'm Sam Williams, and I am a 25-year-old songwriter slash producer, but I'm also a 60s music fan slash expert slash nerd. Each week with this podcast, I take one song by one artist from the 60s and put the show in two parts. First part, so I talk about my opinion of the song and why I think it's so good or why I think it sucks, and do my own personal analysis on the range of the song, which will include the chords, million lyrics, and the second part, so dig deep into the history behind that track. That part, so I talk about who wrote the song, who produced it, what studio the song was recorded at, where that studio was located at, where the, you know, the history behind the musicians that played on the song, whether it be the band members, the studio musicians themselves, the songwriter that wrote the song, the artist that recorded it, and the producer that produced it, and exactly the name of that recording studio and the song was recorded at, and where it was located, and the history behind the record label the song was released on, and the peak musician the song made up on originally when it charted on the Billboard Hot 100 charts, and the year and month the song was released. All that is in the second part of the show. Now, before we move on to this week's episode of the podcast, I have a lot to tell you guys. And as I promised you guys, I took last week off for Thanksgiving, you know, and I hope you guys enjoyed your time off to be with your families, whether it be in person, if you decide to risk it, or if you just did it virtually. I mean, I don't know how you guys feel about that, but that's besides the point. I hope you guys had a great Thanksgiving, but I have a lot to update you guys on before I get to this week's episode of this podcast. And the first thing I have to update you guys on is that I'm sure you guys probably heard the last couple episodes. I dropped a really cool announcement for you guys that I'm going to be releasing a single soon. And I mentioned the release date, December 18th. I think I might have mentioned too. I think the first one I mentioned was December 11th and December 18th. Well, this week, I actually decided I'm going to scrap all those release dates. And the reason why I'm saying this is because I really don't want to have to rush release something right before the holidays or even on the holidays in general. I mean, I was even going to try to put it out on December 25th, but I'm like, no. I mean, I really want to get 2021 off to a fresh new start with brand new original music of mine that no one has heard on the internet yet, and it's new. It's not new to me because these songs I wrote them and recorded them quite a while ago. It's gonna be new to you guys because you guys haven't heard these songs yet. So, and I decided that I'm not gonna put it out for the whole month of December. I'm gonna wait until next month. So the official release date for my first single and my first official music release in 4 years is going to be on January 8th. And that song, it's going to be a two. Now, here's the other cool thing I'm doing. This is you guys will really like this. Since I'm a 60s music throwback artist in general, I mean, I cover various different aspects of that particular decade of music. I decided for my own music, I thought it'd be kind of cool to do something that, you know, was very prevalent at the time during the 60s. And I'm sure you guys know this by now, because I've talked about this on my show endlessly. But back in the 60s, if you bought a single, you never got one song. You always got two songs. Because back then, if you bought a 45 RPM single, you would always have two songs for the price of one. You always get an A side on one side of the record and a B side on the other side of the record. And that's exactly what I'm going to be doing for my single, actually. So check this out. So for my first official single that I'm going to be releasing ever since 2017, really, or my first piece of music I'm officially putting out ever since then, I'm going to be putting out a two-song single. And that's going to be a little different because a lot of people, when they release music, they always put out just one song nowadays. And that's kind of what we're used to now with everyone just putting out like one-song singles. Well, I'm going to be doing something different. I'm going to be putting out a two-song single. You heard me correctly. So on January 8th, you will hear two songs of my own original music that are going to be new stuff you guys haven't heard before. It's not on my website. It's not on any streaming platform. You guys are going to hear this stuff for the first time ever on January 8th. And it's going to be an A-side, B-side single. The songs are going to be Turquoise Apricot on the A-side and She Said No on the B-side. Right now, I'm currently waiting for the artwork to be done for that. But the other thing I wanted to tell you guys is that this is something I've been just wrestling my brain around with for quite a while now. But it's something I've just been kind of, it's been hard for me to come to a real good decision about as far as what to do about this. But, you know, as far as my artist name, right? I mean, of course, on here, I'm Sam Williams. I mean, you know, my website name is samwilliamsmusic.net. That's probably not going to change. But when you guys look me up on Spotify and Apple Music, Tidal, all the major streaming platforms where you guys actually listen to music versus podcasts, because my podcast is my own very unique name that no one else has. But if you guys try to look me up on Spotify or any other streaming music app, aside from like Apple Podcasts and all the places where you can find my podcast, unfortunately, when you type in the name Sam Williams, you'll notice there's a lot of other artists that have that name. In fact, there's one guy on Spotify, and I believe he's on all the other streaming music apps, too. You know, his name is Sam Williams, and he's got a huge following on there. In fact, this is kind of interesting. He's actually the grandson of Hank Williams, the original Hank Williams, because there was Hank Williams Sr. and Hank Williams Jr., and he is the grandson of the original Hank Williams, and his name is Sam Williams. And he's got a big following on Spotify. He's got like 94K monthly listeners a month, and I thought to myself, okay. So I don't want to, I really want to change my name because I don't want to have to compete with him. I don't want people to not be able to find me because of him having such a huge following on, you know, Spotify, you know, with my exact same name as me. And I also, but I don't want to change my name either because I like my name, Sam Williams. It sounds like a cool 60s retro throwback artist and I wouldn't really want to change it. Because then I would have to get a whole new domain name. I have to redesign my artist merch logo. Which you can find that on my website too. But I mean, basically, if I change my name, I'm going to have to go buy something different on my podcast too. I can't be introduce myself and say, I'm Sam Williams and I'm a 25-year-old songwriter / producer. But I'm also a 60 music fan /expert /nerd. And I'll have to go under something else. I don't really want to do that. I also don't want to have an artist name and go under Sam Williams or everything else. That's not happening either because I don't want to have to confuse you guys. So here's what's going to happen with that. My new stage name is actually going to be a slight variation of my name, but there's going to be one big difference between the Sam Williams that's on all the other platforms and me. And my new stage name, now remember, this is very, very important. So I want you guys to get this right because it's a very interesting stage name. And I want to make sure you guys have the right pronunciation for it because it's not what you think it might be. Okay, so my new stage name is going to be Sam L. Williams. Now, when you look it up on Spotify, it's going to be Sam L, capital L, dot Williams. Now, here's the thing. It's not Samuel Williams, even though it's my full name, Samuel Williams. It's going to be Sam, capital L, dot Williams. So Sam L. Williams. And again, I got to say it again. My new stage name I'm going to be going under when I release my first official single in 4 years in 2021 on January 8th is going to be Sam L. Williams. Okay, I'm going to say it again. My new stage name that you're going to find me on all the usual streaming platforms for music is going to be Sam L. Williams. Okay, remember, Sam L. Williams. Okay, so hopefully you guys remember that. And again, like, you know, as soon as I get the pre-save link for this single, I'll throw it in the description of each episode of this podcast I'll put out before the single release because it's going to be on January 8th. So as soon as I get that, I'll throw that in the description of this episode, this podcast. And you guys will absolutely get that before my Instagram people get it. But again, Sam L. Williams, that's going to be my brand new stage name. And again, it's going to be a 2-song single, Turquoise Apricot on the A side, She Said No on the B side. I'm currently waiting on the artwork for that. As soon as I get that, I'll get that pre-save link set up for you guys. But now, here's another really cool announcement for you guys. When I was over the break, right, when I was just taking a break from this podcast over Thanksgiving, I decided to go on Spotify and do some exploring because I realized that I'm going to be releasing some new music soon, and I need to kind of figure out who I'm going to be competing with. Who else is in my niche? What other modern day artists are doing kind of 60s retro sounding music? You know, what other artists today are kind of doing what I'm doing? So I went on this playlist, right? I think the playlist was called Retro Pop. And I discovered an artist that I already knew about. And it was an artist called She and Him. And She and Him, I knew about them because it was Zooey Deschanel's group. And She and Him is her musical project that she kind of did on the side when she was doing all these big acting projects as an actress, appearing on all these movies and TV shows. On the side, she had her own musical project called She and Him. And, you know, it's funny because I remember that name, and I remember, you know, even seeing their music on the Target CD shelves. But for years, I never really checked them out. And the reason being is because I always kind of dismissed them. I thought they were just a folk Americana singer-songwriter, a duo. And that's what their stuff reminded me of. And, I never really considered them anything more than that. And I thought to myself, look, I like that music. It's a lot of great songs in it, but it's really not my wheelhouse. I'm really more into that 60s, you know, pop music and R&B and soul and all that. That's my real wheelhouse. And Eli Paperboy Reed is like that. And that's why I fell in love with his stuff. But check this out. So when I was on that playlist, right, I listened, one of their songs was on there. I'm like, okay, I'll have to listen to this. And I listened to a song off of the third album, which is called Volume 3, I believe. And I listened to a song that was on that playlist from that album. And my jaw literally dropped to the floor. I was like, oh my God! Holy shit! This is exactly in my wheelhouse. And it just, here, let me just put it to you this way, guys. It blew my motherfucking mind. I couldn't believe how much she had that exact, you know, 60s girl group pop sound with her music. I mean, her songs sounded exactly like the classic girl group pop songs written by Jerry Goffin and Carole King, Jeff Berry, Nellie Greenwich, Barry Mann, Cynthia Weil. Her songs sound exactly like that. And I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. I was like, holy crap. And it just blew my mind because not only did her songs give off that vibe and her arrangements gave off that vibe, but her voice sounded exactly like Barbara Lewis and all those classic Dusty Springfield, you know, all those great female singers at that time, Jackie DeShannon. I just couldn't believe how much she had that 60s music, that retro girl group 60s pop thing down to a science with her songs and her arrangements. But it was so fascinating because her music, even though it had that sound with the arrangements and the songs, the productions were totally modern. So I'm talking like, you know, very, very much up to date for that time, like very much like the stuff, the same kind of recording gear that the bands like One Republic and Coldplay and the Killers were using. And even like some of the folky, you know, folk pop groups like Mumford and Sons and Lumineers and Monsters and Men. It's the same equipment, but just totally retro 60s girl group pop music. It blew my mind, and it just really blew my mind that she also had she also was the same age as a lot of those other big names from that time who are girl singers like Lana Del Rey and Katy Perry and Sarah Bareilles and Adele. I mean, oh my God, I just fell in love with her music so much. And the whole reason why I'm mentioning this to you guys is because I think I really did find the perfect next guest for my podcast, because she's kind of the gateway from, you know, people of my generation and the music of the 60s. Because she has such a huge following of people my age group. I mean, people love her from the smash hit show she was on, New Girl. That was a big hit show that was on network TV for a very long time. And also the movie she did in the past, like Elf and 500 Days of Summer. But I don't think a lot of people know about this other side to herself, which is a 60s girl group pop fanatic that she totally is. I mean, she even covered a really obscure song written by Jeff Berry and Nellie Greenwich that Nellie Greenwich put out as a solo single that tanked. It's so obscure, so hard to find, I didn't even know it. So it's just, God, I would just love to have her as a guest on my podcast. And that's kind of where I'm at right now with that. So I reached out to her, WhatsApp sort of, you know, text mailing list number, and hopefully I'll hear back from her. But please pray for me, guys, that I'll have her as a guest on my podcast, because that would get so many people around my age to tune into this podcast, because just hearing her talk about this stuff and just how much people my age love her from all the stuff she did, you know, when I was in high school and even when I was in elementary school. I mean, people would just, you know, people would flip out when they hear about how much she loves this particular decade of music. And I feel like this is something a lot of people don't even really know about her. So it'd be really great for me just to talk to her and get her to talk about this stuff in a very passionate way, and for her to kind of reveal her very musical side to herself, because most people only know her for acting stuff she did. I mean, she's mainly well known as an actress, but very few people know about that really super cool, like super nerdy aspect of herself when she loves that 60s girl group pop stuff. So please pay for me that I'll have her as a guest on my podcast. But so before we move on to this week's episode of this podcast, I have another cool announcement for you guys, because even though she's a maybe, what's another definite maybe that probably will happen is that I was able to get a hold of Felix Cavalieri of the Rascals. Yeah! Oh my God, I can't wait to have him on my podcast, because the Rascals are my all-time favorite 60s band. They're so good. They had that blue-eyed soul sound down to a science. They were incredible musicians. Really, really good group of guys. They wrote most of their own music. They just sounded amazing. I mean, you know, they played without a bass player in the first band to do that. I did them on my podcast for episode 22. So 22 parts 1 and 2, that's when I did them. So it's been a while since I've covered them, but it would be so good to have Felix Cavalieri on my podcast, because he's the man to talk to from that group, because he wrote all the songs and sang lead on most of them too. I mean, he is really the guy. I mean, it would be so cool to get to talk to him. I recently got in touch with his daughter. You know, I hope to hear from her soon. I'll let you guys know as soon as I have that locked in, because that's going to be amazing. Yeah, that's going to be so cool. So, you know, I'll let you guys know when that's locked in. It's going to be over the phone, because he's out of state right now. He doesn't live in LA. I believe he lives in Nashville. I'm pretty sure he lives in Nashville. So it'll be over the phone. It's going to be so good. I can't wait to have him on. I'm really, really excited for that. And, you know, another thing is that I met the son of the guy who wrote Ooh Child by the Five Stair Steps. And he told me the song was written about him. He told me about his dad. And I loved it. I love to have him on my podcast too, because he did a lot of stuff in the 60s. He wrote Remember Then by the Earls and a bunch of Connie Francis B-sides, so a lot of her hits. And I think it would be cool just to get the story behind Ooh Child, because even though that's kind of out of my wheelhouse for this podcast, because it's 60s and that song came out in 1970, I mean, I think maybe one thing I'll do moving forward with this podcast is that as much ground we're going to cover with the 60s, because there's a lot of stuff we haven't covered yet, I might flirt with the 70s just a little bit. I mean, I might do the first half of 1970, and at some point I'll get to the 70s, and I'll kind of cover that a little bit more in detail. But for now, you know, we're still going to do the 60s, because we've still got a lot of stuff we got to cover, a lot of things we haven't talked about yet. So either way, hope to have him on my podcast. I reached out to him. He hasn't gone back to me yet, but love to have him on. So those are all the exciting things I have to update with you guys on. So for now, let's get on with the show. But anyways, I mean, I really do think Zoe has a very unique sound, and I really don't think there really isn't any other current female singer of today that sounds like her. And even though the album came out in 2013, it was her last original album that she put out as an artist. I mean, the next album she did was covers, and she did a bunch of Christmas songs, but she hasn't really put out a full length of her own music in a long time. So that'll be definitely worth covering. And look, even if I can't have her as a guest, I'll definitely be tackling her on my podcast. So that's going to be really cool. I can't wait to even do one of her songs. But anyways, let's get started in this week's song, shall we? Okay. So over the break, when I was taking a break from my podcast, another thing I did, I actually revisited a movie that I haven't seen in years. I mean, I saw it for the first time back in 2007 when I was like 12 years old. I'm pretty sure I was 12 years old when I first saw this movie. And at the time, I thought it was really cool, and I thought there was a lot of unique things about it, but I thought maybe it'd be kind of cool just to kind of revisit it and, you know, talk about it. And it's kind of, and this week's artist is kind of a hint, kind of carkering back to the last interview I did, because the last person I had on my podcast actually asked me about, you know, the band that they talked about in this movie. And the movie she was talking about was a movie called That Thing You Do. That Thing You Do was a movie about, that was produced and I believe directed by Tom Hanks. He might have written the script too. I'm pretty sure that it was his movie all the way. But anyways, The movie was about a fictitious 60s band called The Wonders. And the thing is about this band is that they were called The Wonders because they essentially, the whole movie, and I'm, again, I apologize if I'm spoiling anything for you guys. If you haven't seen the movie, stop listening to this podcast now and go watch it. And then you can always hop in to, and listen back to this episode of this podcast. And then, you know, you'll know the plot for this movie. And I apologize if I'm giving away any spoilers. So it's about to happen. So go watch the movie if you haven't seen it yet. And if, you know, once you watch it, go back and listen to this and you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. Okay. So just now that you have that warning, I'm going to say that the movie The Wonders is about this band, you know, from a small town in Erie, Pennsylvania, and they record this song called That Thing You Do. It was an original song written by one of the members of the band, and then, you know, somehow in that movie, they wind up getting a record deal with a company called Playtone Records. But before they did that, they recorded the song independently inside of a church. And then basically what happened is that they sold the master tape of the song to Playtone, and they get a distribution deal through them. And basically they sell the master tape to Playtone. Playtone buys it. And then because they have mass distribution for Playtone, the single winds up climbing up the charts, and it debuts on a certain number on the Billboard Hot 100 charts, and then it eventually gets into the top 10. And basically, you know, when in the movie, you know, it's interesting because, you know, you see exactly how they feel when they first hear their song on the radio. And then it kind of just, the movie kind of evolves where they do all these big shows and they go on TV and they do all these big tours and there's screaming girls in the audience. And so much of that movie was very much true to real life. And, you know, another thing that was kind of interesting about it is towards the end when Tom Hanks told them, hey guys, so you guys signed a contract with Playtone, and that contract stipulates that you guys cannot record your own music, but you have to record songs that we, as a record label, Playtone Records, currently own the rights to as far as publishing and our catalog is concerned. And, you know, there was that conflict where they didn't want to do that and they wanted to record their own songs, and then they kind of left. And that was very fascinating because it kind of harkens back to the last 60s guy I talked to in my podcast, Mike Vail, the bass player for Tommy James and Sean Dills, because they had a very similar story. Because they, you know, what happened with them is that, you know, the same thing happened with the band and That Thing You Do. They record a song independently. They found a major label deal to distribute the master recording of that song. They didn't re-record it, but they had the major label, or let's just say indie label, distribute that song and, you know, take ownership of the master recording. And basically, what happened was that, you know, the label said, hey, you guys signed a contract. You guys can't record any of your own music. You got to record songs in the Playtone Records catalog. That's exactly what happened to Tommy James and Sean Dells. They basically, that's exactly what Morris Levy told them when they got signed a label. They could not record their own songs at first. They had to record songs that the Roulette record label actually already controlled the rights to. They can only record songs within their catalog. So those are some interesting parallels. But the song I'm doing this week actually kind of parallels that movie to a certain extent, because I thought to myself, okay, so it's been a while since I've done like a garage rock song on my podcast. You know, and I haven't talked about garage rock for a while. I mean, I did a psychedelic rock song. I did Kenny Rogers in the first edition, but garage rock is something I haven't really touched on quite yet, because it's kind of an interesting subgenre of music in the 60s, because it's very fascinating, because it's not psychedelic rock, because it kind of predated that. And I thought to myself, okay, maybe this would be a good time to do like a garage rock one-hit wonder and kind of introduce this genre to you guys and kind of just say, hey, you know, why don't we just talk about it? And so today on my podcast, actually this week technically, on this week for my podcast, I'm going to be doing a band that closely parallels the career of what happened with The Wonders in that movie, That Thing You Do. And this band, this is arguably probably one of the best songs in the garage rock genre, because it so much mimics the British Invasion bands. It mimics them so well. It blows my mind how much it sounds a lot, so much like those British Invasion bands. It's a really good song, and it's a well-written song, and it doesn't, the vocals sound derivative, but the song is very unique. It doesn't sound like any other songs from that time. It doesn't sound similar to anything else that was out at that time, even though the vocals and the production and even the overall arrangement and the vibe of the song was kind of derivative from like the Beatles and a lot of those British invasion bands. The song is very unique, and it's a really, really cool, like, kind of a British Invasion knockoff, but still a very unique song. A lot of high energy. This one's a really cool balls-to-wall rock song from the 60s, and I like those songs too. I don't just like the mushy major 7, minor 7 R&B stuff from the 60s. I like some rock songs too, and this is a good example of that. This song absolutely kicks ass. It's a great 60s garage rock song. I can't wait to talk about this one with you guys. Okay, so the song came out in November 1965. It's by a band called the Knickerbockers. The name of the song is called Lies.
Lies, lies, you're telling me that you'll be true. Lies, lies, that's all I ever get from you. Tears, tears, I shed a million tears for you. Tears, tears, and now you're loving someone new.
Wow. How cool is that? Seriously, damn, that's a really rockin' 60s song. Holy shit, man. I mean, that's just like balls to the wall rock and roll right there. It's a very interesting 60s rock song, and it's really high energy too. And today we're going to talk about what makes a song so fucking great musically and lyrically. But first, let's get into the song's music. Okay, so here's the interesting thing about this song as far as it being a 60s rock song. Songs like this from the 60s, they tend to, as far as the chord progressions is concerned, they tend to fall more on the basic side of things. You tend to hear more things that are not very sophisticated, just a bunch of 1-4-5s and, you know, or just like 1-7-4-5 and kind of what you'd expect from, you know, rock songs in general. I mean, your basic bitch rock song, which is basically like, you know, from the 50s all through the 60s and even in the early 70s and 80s too, most of it is just really basic. A lot of, you know, 1-4-5, you know, or 1-4-1-5 and then 1-4 and then 1-5 again, or 1-7-4-5. I mean, it's kind of what you kind of expect from a lot of, you know, 60s rock songs are 1-7-4. I mean, we're kind of used to all this. I mean, Creedence Clearwater Revival uses chord changes. The Rolling Stones uses chord changes. I mean, even AC/DC uses chord changes like that. And Led Zeppelin does too. So, I mean, you know, we're kind of used to this whole idea of just really basic chord progressions in rock and roll music. And this stems all the way back into the early days of rock and roll with rhythm and blues, and you know when that whole sound developed in the early 50s, going into the mid and late 50s. But the interesting thing about the song is that it sounds kind of basic, but it really isn't. There's a couple things in there that make it not so basic, and now those specific things I'm talking about are the modal interchanges. Because in this song, especially when it gets into that, I guess you would call it like a bridge. I don't even know. And, you know, that's a whole other thing within itself. This song is a weird structure, and I'll get into that in just a few minutes. But let's just focus on the chord progression for now. Okay, so when you listen to the song, right, you know, your first thing you hear is that flat 7 to 1, and you hear that go for a while, and then it goes to the 5, and flat 7, 1, flat 7, 1. And then also, when you listen to that, you know, the flat 7 chord only plays for 2 beats. You know, and then it goes to the 1. So you just hear this thing keep going back and forth for a while. And then for to kind of vary things up in the song, you actually hear a change. You hear it coming from the 5 chord, right? You know, which is the 5, I guess you call it the 5 dominant, you know, that A major chord. And then what happens is that you actually hear something a little different. You actually hear a 6 minor major 2 chord progression. And that's a modal interchange because you got that E major in there and that doesn't belong in D major. So you got that E major in there and you got the B minor in there. And then all of a sudden you're like, whoa, what's going on? This is definitely more complicated than what you expect. And so you hear that, you know, that minor six, major two progression, and then you're like, wow, okay, that's different. And then it goes back to the flat 7-1. And then also, it does actually does something kind of cool after it goes to flat 7-1. You hear the five chord, and then you hear the four chord, and then you actually hear it go back to that that minor six chord. And if you think about it, the song kind of resolves on that minor six chord, and that's weird. And that's actually, when a song resolves on a minor six chord, there's a term for that, and people use this in music theory all the time. That's called a modal interchange, not a modal interchange, but a descent of cadence. When a song doesn't end exactly on the one atonic major one chord, and it ends on a totally different chord, like, you know, the minor six chord, that's a descent of cadence, and this song is the perfect example of that. But it's interesting because even though it ends on that minor six chord, you kind of expected for there to be more, but really there isn't any more. And it's interesting because when the song, the first couple times around when it ends on that minor six chord, it goes back to that minor six major two progression, and then that repeats for a while. And then after that minor six major two progression, when it goes from B minor to E major, after you hear that, it does something really, really strange. And this is when it gets interesting. So after you hear that minor six, major two thing for a while, the major two, all of a sudden you're landed into the major three. So you hear B minor, E major for a while, and then you hear an F sharp major. And then all of a sudden you're going back and forth between F sharp major and E major, going from major three to major two. And then the flat seven lands you directly into the main part of the song, which is that flat 7-1 thing. And the other thing I wanted to point out to you about this song is that while all this is happening, there's so much high energy going on with the performance of the song. I mean, the song is really upbeat, super catchy, and there's even a section of the song where there's a guitar solo in it. But the thing is about the guitar solo for the song is that it's not like a very obvious guitar solo. You can't really exactly pick out what he's doing. He's kind of just sort of riffing off of the song's main riff and kind of playing his own little licks here and there, but he's not doing a full guitar solo. And it's kind of interesting because even though that song does have a guitar solo in it, the main part of the thing that's driving the song home are the backup harmonies that the singers sing in this song, because those are very layered and very complex. And, you know, you can especially hear it because it comes in like literally there's an eighth note pickup in this song, and then it just hits you right there, you know, with the lead singer, and you hear the backup singers on at the exact same time. And there's something about that when that song hits you with that big, you know, hook at the very beginning of the song. It just hits you with a ton of bricks, and just the song literally puts the pedal to the metal whenever you listen to it. And it's very interesting, you know, because it's one of those songs where it's like there's a very powerful hook, but there's a lot of melodic stuff happening too, especially, you know, when it resolves, you know, before it resolves to that six minor, it does that, you know, five major, four major thing, and then it resolves to six minor. I mean, there's that little melodic hook in there, you know, that sounds really cool, you know, when it says the title of the song. But it's such a great song, and a lot of interesting things about the song is that you actually hear some power chords in here, but they're not exactly distorted power chords. They're clean power chords played by the rhythm guitar players in the song. And then you hear the drum fill do those really, really cool drum fills in the song. And then you just hear, and again, the song's really all about the drums and the guitar and the vocals. This is definitely one of the songs. It's very vocal driven, very guitar driven, and definitely very drum driven as well. So all those things make it for more of an interesting rock song, because like I said before, I mean, when it comes to rock music in general, you're kind of just used, especially classic rock, you're so used to hearing the basic chord changes. I mean, let's take an example. I mean, the Rolling Stones, I mean, one of their classic, most well-known songs, You Can't Always Get What You Want, is literally just two chords most of the time. I mean, then it goes to that two major and the four, but that's it. I mean, it's just 1-2 one four the whole time. And then it goes to that major two, and then it goes to the four, but that's it. You know, it does that secondary dominant thing, and then that's it, you know? And it's interesting because this song, it feels like it has a basic chord progression, but it doesn't. It's just basically just, there's a lot of extra things thrown in there that make it seem less typical for a rock song. The other thing I want to point out to you about this song is that it's there's a lot of it. The structure is very, very strange, because you would expect a song to sort of, you don't, there's a lot of songs where you don't hear the chorus right away. A lot of times you just hear, like, you know, the verses and the pre-chorus, and but this is one of those songs where you literally, the chorus is the first thing you hear. You hear the chorus, and then you hear, I guess you would say, like, a verse, maybe. I don't even know if you call it a verse, but hits you with the chorus, and then you hear that, and then you hear this, I guess you call it like a bridge, maybe. I don't even know. And then it goes back into the chorus again, but the chorus is slightly different. And then you hear a different lyric in there. And then it goes into this really weird, I don't even know what you call it. I guess it's a bridge, you know, where the singer goes, you think you're such a smart girl and I'll believe what you say. You know, it's that when you hear that part, it's like, okay, is that a bridge or is that a verse, a second verse? Because it kind of sounds like it could be a combination of both. I mean, the song, very weird structure. It's not typical. And a lot of 60s songs are like this because, you know, I mean, back in those days, there were very little rules as to what kind of songs, how songs could be structured in order to be a hit. Because honestly, as long as a song was under 3 minutes and it was catchy and it was there was a lot of good musicianship on it, you know, it was bound to be a hit. You know, so well, there weren't really too many rules as to exactly how you could, as what you could do as far as like song structure is concerned. You can basically do whatever you wanted. You didn't have to stick to a specific formula that was already there before you even started writing. You know, so this is one of those songs that has that kind of weird song structure that you're not used to hearing when you listen to songs. But let's get into the song's lyrics now. Now that I've kind of dived into the song, what makes a song so cool musically. Okay, so I really don't want to get political on this podcast, but you know, here's the thing. So even if you've never had a significant other that flat out lied to your face, right? You might have. I mean, this song might resonate with you so much because, you know, you might have an ex-girlfriend or a boyfriend that just fucking lied to you all the time, and you never really believe what they told you, and it was a toxic relationship and you just ended it with them. You know, you might be one of those people that just had a girlfriend or a boyfriend like that. And but that's not really the point I'm trying to make about this song. I'm not one to get political on my podcast, but you know, what I'm trying to say is that you can basically create a direct parallel between the lyrics to the song and our current president of the United States, who is now about to become our ex-president in the United States. Because regardless of where you stand on the political spectrum, whether you be on the left side or the right side, you cannot deny the fact that he was, in fact, a compulsive liar. And he lied ever since he got sworn in the office, and he still lies even though he's not going to be our president anymore. But yet he still has like literally like a month and a half left, actually kind of like maybe like 5 or 6, 8 weeks left in office. You know, I think he's got, wait a minute, I think he's actually got more than that. I think he's got at least 10 weeks left, but I mean, that's besides the point. I mean, you know, when he got sworn in the office, and right now he's still very much lying to the American public. And when you listen to these songs lyrics, right, the guy says, look, I can't believe a word you say. You're going to make me sad someday. You know, someday I'm going to be happy, but I don't know where, just when. You know, you're breaking my heart. You know, it's just the lyrics in the song. He's talking about how sad he is that his girlfriend fucking lied to his face all the time. And a lot of people are very upset and angry at the fact that our current president of the United States, who's not going to be our president of the United States anymore, has lied to us since day one. And he continues to lie to the American public. And, you know, that just kind of proves how relatable the song is right now, despite the fact that it was written before he was even on our radars, you know? And it's just amazing how someone like a song like this could really, you know, you can make a direct correlation between what's going on right now with our current president of the United States and the song, which is basically 55 years old, you know, and that there's really something to be said about that. And, you know, it's, again, it's like you might not be able to relate to the song because you might, you know, have gone through your life with really, really good, solid relationships with people that never lied to you at all whatsoever. And they were always truthful with you, which is basically what you want. You don't want people who are going to lie to you. But unfortunately, what's going on with our government and the way our president of the United States is currently acting, he's basically lying to all of us. You know, and it's just the facts. You know, he's spreading misinformation. He's not being truthful to us. And he's doing it because that's all he ever cares about is himself. So, you know, that's basically what this song is about. You know, it's like this girl doesn't care about him. You know, she's just spreading lies and cheating on him with other guys. And, you know, she just doesn't care. And I feel like that's basically what our president of the United States is basically like right now. He's lying to the American public and he's not being truthful with them because he just doesn't care. All he cares about is himself. You know, I mean, he can see that he's basically almost out of here and that his days are numbered and that he's going to be gone pretty soon. So, you know, he's on his last breath, you know, as a leader of this country that I live in, which is America. So, you know, there's definitely some parallels between the lyrics and the song and what's currently going on with our country right now. And this is a good example of that because he's basically like, you know, the title of the song says it all. I mean, the song's called Lies. Well, our president of the United States is currently telling lies, you know. So, you know, there's something timeless about that because obviously in 1965, he wasn't even around or he wasn't even on our radars. He was just some Joe Schmo. He was like an 18-year-old kid. But, you know, the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, even though you can easily make a direct correlation between what's currently going on in our country right now and the lyrics of the song. So even if you never heard it before, I'm pretty sure you'll be able to relate to it, especially if you currently live in America. Moving on, let's talk about the history behind the Knickerbockers. But while we're at it, let's talk about garage rock for a minute. I won't spend too much time on this because I know that I'm pretty close to an hour with this podcast already. I mean, if it's a little too long, I'm sorry. I had a lot of things to tell you guys in the beginning, and I know the intro went a little bit too long before I actually started the episode, but I took a week off and a lot of things happened when I took that week off, so I had to tell you guys all about them, those things that happened while I was not doing my podcast. But anyways, garage rock was a very fascinating genre of music in the 60s that is kind of neglected, not nearly as talked about as, you know, other things such as British Invasion and Motown and Brill Building and other things of that time and R&B soul too, because it's a very specific niche in 60s music history. And it's very fascinating because, you know, it kind of got started even before the Beatles, because, you know, even before, like, we had this whole thing about, oh, the Beatles are the first band to write their own songs and sing and, you know, play on their own records and be totally self-contained. You know, even before that, there were actually bands that sang and played, you know, accompanied themselves. I mean, they weren't vocal groups. They didn't just sing and had a band backing them up. There were bands that sang and accompanied themselves. But for the most part, these bands were doing mostly cover songs. And there were very few bands before the Beatles that actually wrote their own material and played and sang on their own records. And the whole garage rock genre kind of got started with that. And there's a bunch of songs within the genre of garage rock that, you know, basically, you know, these bands that kind of got started right before the Beatles, you know, they covered these songs and threw them in their set list. And basically, and the way they recorded these songs and played them, it was a very interesting sort of way they did this, because why it was even called garage rock in the first place is because, you know, when you listen to these songs, right, they're not clean, sophisticated, classy, very elegant, sort of beautiful arrangements like a lot of the Brill Building stuff was coming out of. It was really super grungy and raw and in your face and just really just dirty. I mean, that's the best way to describe these records. They're so just dirty as hell. I mean, they didn't sound clean or sophisticated or very just upper crust. They sounded really raw, in your face, bare bones. And in fact, a lot of these songs even sound like they're recorded inside of a garage. And that's what kind of what gave the, that's why the genre is called garage rock, because a lot of these songs, when you listen to them, they sound like they're recording someone's garage. The recording quality even wasn't the best of the best at that time. It wasn't like top quality studios, top quality arrangers, top quality musicians. It was just a bunch of guys getting together and just grooving, and just, you got that organ in there and you got the guitars and all these really just sloppy guitar solos and really just raw in your face organ playing. And just, and the other thing about garage rock that kind of set itself apart from other genres of music at that time is that it wasn't just the raw recording quality and the raw musicianship and just how it kind of sounded like shit, really. But also, it was the way these songs were sung. Because the way these songs were sung, it was very, like, not what you would expect, you know, from that time. You know, because at the time, this was like in 1963, right? At the time, you were kind of expecting songs to be sung by guys very elegantly, with very deep, not with a tenor voice, very kind of that pop thing that we're kind of used to. And that's what you heard a lot on the radio at that time. But when you heard songs like Louie Louie by the Kingsmen and Surfin' Bird by the Trashmen, you heard these really raw, in your face, just sloppy, just like totally like, you know, like in, like not even like remotely close to clean and sophisticated that a lot of other pop records are coming out of at that time. So, you know, that's kind of how the genre of music kind of came about. And a lot of these bands are signed to independent labels, and a lot of them also came out of cities and, you know, states that you wouldn't necessarily expect them to come out of. Like, for example, one of the first big hits within the garage rock genre was at Rizzling Court in Portland, Oregon. Another big hit that came out just right after that was recorded in Minneapolis, Minnesota. So, I mean, it's just, you never know where these records can come out of, because they can come out of the weirdest freaking places you can imagine. I mean, you know, it's just, they came from all over the place. I mean, San Francisco, L.A., you know, I mean, even Detroit. I mean, there were some places where, you know, just weird places you wouldn't necessarily expect hit records to come out of. And, you know, like, you know, San Jose. I mean, there were so many places where a lot of these classic garage rock records came out of. I mean, Texas is a really good example, because a lot of garage rock hits came out of Texas, too. So it was very, it was just... When you think of garage rock, you have to think of that grungy lead vocal, that really raw, in-your-face, just pedal-to-the-metal vocal, and those sloppy guitar solos, and just really funky sort of, you know, really chunky sort of like dirty like organ playing, and just sloppy drums that sound like they're recorded like with one microphone and just live. You know, that's the real feel of garage rock. You know, I mean, a great example of this, listen to the Kingsmen's Money That's What It Want. And that's the other thing, is that that's actually a really good example of a 60s song that got covered by a lot of garage rock bands. I mean, you know, there are certain songs that just float around, you know, within the garage rock community that just got covered quite a lot. And that was one of them. And Tommy James and Shondells was one of those bands, too. But they kind of cleaned up and became more of a mainstream pop rock act. But again, like, if you guys want to learn more about them, check out the episode I did on them. Plus, check out the interview I did with Mike Vail, because that was pretty cool, too. So, I'm the bass player of that band. But anyways, so that's really what the spirit of garage rock was at the time. And the other thing you have to keep in mind about garage rock is that most of these bands that came out of the garage rock scene in the 60s were not, like, huge hit makers. For the most part, almost all of them were either one or two hit wonders. And they, you know, it's one of those things where it's like they were all recorded very poorly. These songs were not the best as far as production quality was concerned. And they just happened to get picked up by a major and indie label, and they just, the stars aligned, and they managed to get like one hit song or maybe even two. And if you don't know what I mean by hit song, go listen to last interview episode I did with Cap Hamilton. I broke that down and gave you a pretty good idea for what I mean when I say a hit song. Well, that's what a lot of these bands did. All they had was like one or two hit songs. They didn't have millions and millions of hits. I mean, the closest think to a garage rock band that had the most success, arguably, would probably be either be the Five Americans or the McCoys. But I'll get into them later in different episodes of this podcast. But for now, let's focus on this band, because this was definitely one of those classic one-hit wonders from the 60s. And this is just a great example of what garage rock was all about and where these bands kind of came from. Because again, they all started in the garage, but they also cut their teeth playing bar gigs, you know, because this is how these bands developed their raunchy sort of raw in your face sound, was playing at bars, you know. And you know, that's basically how these bands kind of developed. And the Beatles did that too, but this was kind of the American equivalent to that. But anyways, let's get into the history behind. So the Knickerbockers were originally this bar band slash garage band and they're originally from Bergenfield, New Jersey. And, you know, the thing to keep in mind about the Knickerbockers is that they actually got formed in 1962. So the thing you have to keep in mind about this band is that this was before the Beatles, right? Because the Beatles came on the scene in February of 1964 with I Want to Hold Your Hand and all that. So, in 1962, right, what was the biggest dance craze that was sweeping a nation at the time? Several records were being made with this dance craze. And that dance craze was called the Twist. So, if you can imagine, like, when they got formed in 1962, that was most of the material they were probably playing live at the time. They were probably doing all the big twist hits at the time, like Twist in the Night Away, you know, Dear Lady Twist, all the big twist hits at that time, Peppermint Twist. I mean, there's so many Twist songs that were recorded at that time. So they were that's probably what they were doing in most of the bars and clubs they were playing at that time. And that's basically, you know, that was the gist of them during that early period. I mean, they were basically a bar cover band. And they originally consisted of Buddy Randall on vocals and sax, Bo Charles on guitar and vocals, and his brother John Charles on bass and vocals, and Jimmy Walker on drums. Now, the cool part about this band is that they actually had one member of the group who, by the way, was Buddy Randall, who was previously in another really cool, like, one-hit wonder 50s rock band called the Royal Teens. And their biggest hit was a song called Short Shorts. Now, there were two other members of the Royal Teens at that time that would later go on and do a lot of big stuff. And you know what they are? Getting ready, drum pull. Those two members were Bob Gaudio and Al Kooper. Bob Gaudio, who, you know, at the time was a member of the Royal Teens. After they broke up, he would later go on to form Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. You know, he would become a member of that band, and he write most of all the songs. And, you know, Al Kooper, who was also in that group at the time, you know, when he was just a teenager, he would later go on to form Blood, Sweat, and Tears and play on Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone. So that's really cool that Buddy Randall was in the band with all those guys. And that's super cool. And their name actually kind of has an interesting origin. It comes from a street in New Jersey called Knickerbocker Road, County Road 505. And that street actually runs through Tenafly, which is the next town east from Bergenfield, New Jersey. So Tenafly was right next to Bergenfield, and the street runs through both of those two small towns, which are basically located in New Jersey. And Jimmy Walker was actually with a group called the Castle Kings, who were signed to Acco Records before he was in the Knickerbockers. And that's really cool. You know, so those bands definitely, you know, came from interesting backgrounds. And what happened was this. So they kicked around for a while playing cover songs and just doing chasing down all the trends they could possibly imagine. And then basically what happened was this. They hooked up with a guy named Jerry Fuller. Now, if you don't know the name Jerry Fuller, remember when I did Ricky Nelson earlier this year on my podcast? Well, Jerry Fuller was the guy who wrote most of the big hits for Ricky Nelson at that time. He didn't write all of them, but he wrote a lot of them. And he basically, after he wrote all those hits for Ricky Nelson, he was a Texas guy. He was from Texas, but he wound up in L.A. after he was playing with the Champs, and the Champs did gigs in Los Angeles, and he wound up staying there writing hits for Ricky Nelson. After that, he actually got drafted into the Army. And this was in 1963-64, so this was kind of during the British invasion. He went into the Army, and then he actually got discharged in 1965. And in 1965, he found himself actually becoming a A&R man slash songwriter for a record label called Challenger Records. And Challenger Records, the label was actually owned, check this out, was owned by a guy named Gene Autry. And Gene Autry was this big, you know, cowboy superhero guy that was big in the 40s and 50s. Very, very big guy. Well, he was signed to a label that was owned and controlled by Gene Autry. You know, and that label was Challenge Records. It's actually Challenge Records. But yeah, I mean, he was signed to that label, and it was based in New York. And what happened was that, you know, they basically hired him as an A&R man slash songwriter. And, you know, they took him to New York, and he was basically there to basically look for artists and, you know, to add on to the Challenger roster. And that's where he discovered the Knickerbockers. And, you know, he found the Knickerbockers at this really cool place in this bar in Albany, New York, called the University Twist Palace. And then that's when he signed them to Challenger Records. Now, actually, they're actually from the label was based in L.A., but he got assigned to their New York offices. And that's how he discovered the Knickerbockers. It wasn't a New York label. It was an L.A. label. But yeah, so, you know, he went to New York and discovered the Knickerbockers, and then he brought him back to L.A. in 1965, and that's where they basically recorded, you know, most of their songs was in L.A. And, you know, a lot of the songs that they did were, you know, kind of just mediocre songs that weren't very good and kind of almost kind of ripoffs of stuff that was already happening. I mean, they tried to do the surf rock thing. They tried to do the dance craze thing. And nothing was really clicking for a while. But again, this was a band that was trying to write their own music, but at the same time, just chasing down all the big popular fads that were happening at that time in popular music, from everything from surf rock, you know, to, you know, Four Seasons sounding kind of music, you know, with the falsetto and everything, you know, and just pure, you know, dance rock. I mean, they were chasing down all of the trends, right, that were big at that time. And then that's when they recorded a song called Lies, which was an original song written by Buddy Randall and Bo Charles. And basically what happened was this. When they originally wrote Lies, they, you know, they really, really, really tried to sound like a band from the British Invasion. They were desperately trying to, you know, write something within that genre. And they actually wrote Lies in less than 1.5 hours. And they originally recorded it in New York. They demoed it in New York. And basically, you know, Jerry Fuller, who was their producer, decided, hey, this sounds good, guys. I want to try to rearrange it and try to make it into an actual hit song. So what they did is that, you know, they re-recorded the track at Sunset Sound Studios in Hollywood, with Bruce Bochnick being the engineer on the session. And when they did this, they realized things were not really that, things weren't swinging that right with the song. So what they did is that they took the multi-track master of the song, right, that was recorded at Sunset Sound Studios in West Hollywood, which I believe is still there. It's a very legendary studio. It's big. A lot of big hit songs are recorded there, and it's actually on Sunset Boulevard. I believe it's on the corner of Sunset and Highland. I'm pretty sure that's where it's at, if I remember correctly, because I used to see it all the time. There's a photo of me with Sunset, me at basically right at the front door of Sunset Sound Studios, or at least where the building is. There's a picture of me right there. So that's actually kind of cool that I have a photo with me in Sunset Sound Studios. I did a photo shoot in Hollywood one time, and that's where we shot. That was one of the locations of the photo shoot. But anyways, so they took that multi-track master, and they actually took it to Leon Russell's house in the Hollywood Hills. And, you know, basically, you know, Jerry Fuller actually knew Leon Russell from his, because he was around the Wrecking Crew guys a lot, because he, you know, wrote a bunch of songs for Ricky Nelson, and he knew Leon from his days of being in the Wrecking Crew, right? And, you know, Leon had this really cool little studio at his house, which consisted of a 4-track tape machine. And basically what they did is that the band recorded all their vocals for the song at Leon Russell's house on his 4-track tape machine. And what they did is that really raunchy sort of raw in-your-face lead guitar part that was played in the song. And check this out. So I hate to, you know, claim something that may or may not be true. And I hate to sort of, go on falsehoods for this podcast, but I do believe this is true. And I'll probably ask Jerry Fuller about this for sure. He probably remembers, but I was reading an article once a long time ago that say that Jerry Cole, who is a member of the Wrecking Crew, a really cool guitar player at the time, actually was the one who played lead guitar in the song and not members of the band, but the band members are playing on the song. You are hearing members of the band on the song, but to give the song extra beef and really fill up the given a more fuller sound to really just make this record pop, Jerry Fuller recruited a session guitar player from the Wrecking Crew, Jerry Cole, to play on the song. And I do believe that is true. And it's interesting because they probably overdubbed his lead guitar part at Leon Russell Studio. And it's interesting because they actually recorded that guitar part on an old beat-up Fender guitar amp. And that's basically how they got that sound on this record. So it was recorded at two studios, at United Sunset Sound in West Hollywood, Bruce Botnick, and then at Leon Russell's house in the Hollywood Hills in a 4-track tape machine. Okay, so now let's give a little background on the release of the song. Okay, so it came out in November 1965, and it debuted, I believe, in December of 65, and by the very, very beginning of 66, the first month of 66, it was in the top 20. I believe it peaked at number 19, and it was there at the very beginning of 1966 in January of that year. And so they had a big hit song, right? And kind of like in that movie, That Thing You Do, I mean, they played on the radio, and it became a hit. And then the band was kind of kept on the road for a while, but their next hit song, you know, they didn't make the top 40, actually. It almost was a hit, but it only peaked at number 45 on the Billboard Hot 100 chart, so it technically doesn't count as a hit. But I do believe that One Track Mind, which is their follow-up to Lies, actually did really, really well in L.A., in certain regions of the country. It was probably top 10, definitely on, you know, KHJ and the KRLA and those specific AM radio charts in L.A. at that time. It probably did very, very well as a regional hit, but not... It didn't make the top 40 nationally. So that technically puts him in the one-hit wonder category because he only had one Billboard top 40 hit on the Hot 100 charts. But before I end this podcast, I wanted to share a quick little insight about the connection between this band, the Knickerbockers and Lies, and that movie I watched over Thanksgiving break, That Thing You Do. I just found out from a very credible source who actually tried to pitch songs to be used for that movie, That Thing You Do, that when they were trying to, when the producers of that movie were trying to, replicate the sound of the 60s, you know, by having people pitch their original music for the movie, and they weren't really that interested in using, like, actual music from that time, the producers, I believe Tom Hanks, and again, Tom Hanks wrote the movie, he wrote the script and produced it. I think he was very much the guy behind that movie, and he directed it too. They basically wanted what they were using for the reference tracks. What they specifically wanted for the movie were songs that sounded like, you know, the two hits this band had, more like the one hit. I mean, but just the two most well known songs this band had, "Lies" and "One Track Mind." They wanted songs that sounded just like those songs, you know, but they weren't trying to copy it, but they were trying to get close to it. But they wanted songs that had that vibe of the songs by this band, the Knickerbockers, the two most well-known songs, which are Lies and One Track Mind. So anyways, you know, basically when they were producing that movie, That Thing You Do, which you, I believe, are going to watch on HBO, they're basically using this band, the Knickerbockers, as a reference, and they were using their two big hit songs they had, or more or less their one national top 40 hit and their biggest regional hit. You know, they were using those two songs as a point of reference, you know, for that movie. You know, That Thing You Do, which totally captures the essence of that mid-60s garage band, which is what I'm talking about on this podcast. But yeah, so that's a cool little insight that I just found out about this band, and I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Okay, so here's just a quick little epilogue exactly what happened with the band after they had their one-hit song, Lies. I mean, they appeared on Where the Action Is, which is Dick Clark's, one of his biggest daytime TV programs for teenagers at the time for popular music. They kind of broke up in the late 60s, and Jimmy Walker actually became a part of the Righteous Brothers and replaced Bill Medley in the group in 1968. And Walker recorded some solo singles for Columbia Records in 1968 and 69. And then Buddy Randall left shortly after that. And but, you know, Bo Charles and Johnny Charles actually, you know, reformed the Walker Brothers with members Richie Walker, Eric Swanson, and Barry McCoy. But then, you know, Buddy Randall then rejoined the Knickerbockers, but then left again in 1970. And Barry McCoy actually left and joined Gary Puck and Union Gap. So as you can see, there are a bunch of different, you know, bands coming, you know, members coming and going with, you know, basically, you know, in a bunch of different groups. And Bo Charles did some singles under a different name, Columbus Jones, in 69 for White Whale Records. And a lot of those singles were actually produced by George Tobin, who will later go on to manage and produce the big, you know, teenage star in the 80s, Tiffany. So that's pretty cool. So, you know, that's a little nice little connection right there. So, you know, just a quick little epilogue on what happened with after them. So, but anyway, so that concludes episode number 120 of my 60 Music Podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and he found out some really cool and interesting facts about this week's artist and song, and you liked my analysis in this week's artist and song. You never heard of this band before, and you're a millennial, and you're around my age, and you fell in love with this song and thought, wow, this is so cool. And you're like, wow, I didn't really know anything about, you know, this song at all. Well, you can, if you're like that, please email me at samltwilliamicloud.com, or you can also reach out to me on Instagram, iHeartOldies, and check out more of my original music at samwilliamsmusic.net. Like I said before, I'm going to say it again. My next official music release single is coming out on January 8th. So, and it's going to be, the songs are going to be Turquoise Apricot on the A side and She Said No on the B side. So again, it's coming out on January 8th. And this name that it's coming out under is not the name I address myself in my podcast, Sam Williams, but Sam L. Williams. So it's, again, it's Sam, capital L, dot Williams. So remember that. So that's what's going to come out under. It's not Sam Williams, but Sam, capital L, dot Williams. So remember that. Sam L. Williams. That's the name it's going to come out under. And I'll, like I said before, once, as soon as I get the pre-save link set up, I'll you know, drop that link in the description of this episode, this podcast, so that you guys can click on it. You can pre-save the single when it comes out, you know, so that way it goes directly into your library, you know, as soon as it releases. So, yeah, so that's another announcement. And in the meantime, you can check out the official Spotify and YouTube playlist for this podcast. There you'll be able to find all the songs I've talked about on my show so far, including some of the ones I mentioned, interview episodes. And, you know, that's a really, those are really, really fun, because you'll get to see what kind of music I talk about on my podcast in the first place. You know, you get a good idea for that. And if listening to those playlists gives you any ideas for the kind of songs I should talk about next on my podcast, and I haven't yet, please email those ideas to me at samlzwilliamicloud.com, or you can also reach out to me on Instagram at iHeartOldies, and, or check out more of my original music at samwilliamsmusic.net. Also, everything you can check out is the official Redbubble merch store for this podcast, which has a super cool logo that I personally came up with a design for myself. It's basically the catchphrase I say at the end of every podcast and keep on chucking tie-dye on with my name and podcast in the bottom. So, and that's really cool. We'll love it if you can check that out. If you'd like to purchase anything, let me know. Please email me at samltwilliamicloud.com and let me know what you got and how, you know, what you think of the podcast and everything. And by the way, it's the holiday season right now. So what I'm going to try to do is if just to kind of give you guys a little added incentive to maybe purchase something from the store, is I want to see if you guys, I'm going to see if there's any if I could do any kind of holiday deals happening, you know, with my store, if I can give you guys a possible discount, maybe, you know, since it's a holiday season going on right now and a lot of companies are doing that, you know, to give people incentive to stay home and buy stuff online instead of crowding the stores right now because of what's happening with COVID. So if I see anything like that through Redbubble, and if I can make anything like that happen, I'll let you guys know, and I'll definitely do it because I want you guys to support, you know, what I'm doing and purchase something from the store. You know, it mean a lot to me, you know, so I'll see if I can make that happen. And, you know, I'll definitely let you guys know if there's a deal happening with one of the items in my store or all the items in my store, if it's like 50% off, 25% off, you know, whatever, because I know that you guys would definitely appreciate that, especially if you're not making a whole lot of money right now, because maybe you're unemployed because you lost your job because of COVID. So it'd be nice to get that little discount from me, you know, if you give you a little bit more of an extra incentive, to, you know, for you guys to get something from the store. So, yeah. So anyways, I'm Sam Williams. And thank you guys for tuning in to this week's episode of my podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. And until next week, please keep things groovy.